This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with two members of the Code Pink delegation who had boots on the ground in Gaza. We'll also be speaking with Vivek Chibber, a member of the board of directors and an organizer of this year's huge Left Forum. Over 200 panels. The Left Forum this year is called Turning Points. Stay with us. In February, a delegation from the U.S. anti-war group Code Pink brought humanitarian aid and emotional support to women and women's organizations in Gaza. They also pressured the U.S., Egyptian, and Israeli governments to lift the ongoing blockade against the Palestinians there. According to the United Nations Children's Fund, the Israeli attack that began on December 27th and lasted for 22 days left over 1,000 people dead, including 412 children and 110 women, and more than 5,000 people injured, which included 1,855 children and 795 women. We talked today with two members of the Code Pink delegation, Helen Schiff and Felice Gelman, who both were over in Gaza and will give us firsthand accounts of who they talked to and what they saw and what they think needs to be done. Felice Gelman, Helen Schiff, welcome to Law and Disorder. You know, the old canard, and I'm going to ask both of you this question. Amongst the American Jewish establishment, which fiercely gives Israel a blank check to do everything, and if anybody criticizes them, they're either anti-Semites or, in our case, if they're Jewish, they're self-hating Jews. So my question to both of you, Felice, and to you, Helen, is, Helen, especially, what's a nice Jewish girl from Great Neck doing in the Gaza Strip?
Well, growing up in Great Neck in the 50s, actually, a lot of the Jewish community was very liberal and supported the civil rights movement, which that was my first picket line in 12th grade. I marched in a picket line around Woolworths in Great Neck. That was kind of my entry into radical politics in a way. I supported civil rights, and I remember my mother having these little spoons with little babies on them saying, 1948, Israel was born. And I thought to myself, well, how can Palestinians there have civil rights if it's a Jewish state? And then when I went to college in Berkeley, I got involved in protesting against the war in Vietnam, and I understood colonialism. And then it dawned on me that actually, and I read some history about Israel, that the formation of Israel was on the behest of British and then later American colonialism. And I saw Israel support the French in Algeria, support France and Britain in a war against Egypt for the Suez Canal. I saw Israel support the Afrikaners in South Africa. And so I realized that this is the Palestinian struggle is a colonial struggle. That's how I came to support it, and that's how I got to Gaza.
And Felice Gelman, what's a nice Jewish girl from Tarrytown, New York, doing in Gaza?
Okay, well, I have to start by saying I'm married to a nice Jewish guy, but I'm not a nice Jewish girl. But I got interested because my husband was born in Haifa, Palestine, before the formation of the State of Israel. And he came to the United States before Israel began. But his whole family live in Israel, and we've traveled there many, many times, really starting in 1970. And been to the West Bank. I think I understood a lot about Israel, but really hadn't been politically active until our daughter began working with ISM in Nablus.
The International Solidarity Movement in Nablus,
where she basically tried to interpose herself between the Palestinians and the occupying force of the Israeli army. When she came back and told what she saw, we had to go for ourselves and see for ourselves. So we went to the West Bank in 2004. And anybody who has really visited the West Bank and visited with Palestinians knows that they can't do nothing. They must become involved because the injustice, the oppression is just so overwhelming, you can't dodge it. And I have to agree with Helen, it is completely reminiscent of the civil rights movement. And if you were active in that, as I was also, you just can't not do anything.
Well, both of you ladies were in Gaza with Code Pink. Can you tell us a little bit about Code Pink and what specifically the organization was doing in Gaza?
Code Pink organized this delegation to Gaza for several different reasons. One was to deliver humanitarian aid to a people under siege. Perhaps even more, and so we did bring $10,000 in aid, but perhaps even more important than that was to break the blockade of Gaza. Since the Hamas government was elected in 2006, there has been a closing of the borders, both through Egypt, and Egypt has been complicit, you know, with Israel, and through Israel. Basically, Gaza has become the largest open-air prison in the world, with very few goods being allowed in or out, with people not being allowed to go out to see relatives, to go to the hospital, to go to work. So it was to try to draw attention to this blockade. And actually, we didn't think we would get in. And we thought that we would be able to draw a lot of attention and publicity. But the Egyptian government, afraid of people piling up at the border, because the Galloway caravan came with 125 trucks. They were a day behind us. If we had all gathered up at the border, we would have gotten a lot of publicity. So in a sense, they let us through to avoid that kind of publicity.
That's the member of parliament, British George Galloway, that led this huge caravan across North Africa, finally to Gaza, and got in.
We throw around the word siege and blockade, and people think they know what that means. They don't know what it means. They don't know what it means. We haven't actually, modern warfare doesn't have sieges, right? The last siege was the Battle of Leningrad, as far as I can see, which means people locked in to a territory, unable to flee, and attacked with all of modern military armament. But that's really what a siege means. And if you just to give you an example for Gaza, Gaza is about the size of Philadelphia. The current number of trucks that are bringing supplies into Gaza last week was 758, so about 100 a day. Philadelphia, across one bridge, which is where I was able to find this, one single bridge, and of course they have many ways to get into Philadelphia, has 8,700 trucks a day entering Philadelphia. So imagine trying to live, the population trying to live on basically less than one-tenth of what goes into Philadelphia every day to sustain life. It's an impossible situation.
Tell us a little bit about Code Pink for those listeners who aren't familiar with the organization.
Code Pink is an anti-war organization, a women's organization that was really began with the invasion of Iraq and with the environment that came after 9/11 of the U.S. being in a war on terror. And it was the name Code Pink comes from the Homeland Security's efforts to indicate how much danger Americans were in by having codes of red, yellow, orange, whatever.
Mauve and heliotrope.
Mauve and heliotrope, right. So Code Pink is a primarily women's organization. It is prepared to do whatever is necessary and outrageous, as indicated by the Code Pink, to oppose war and to look for peace internationally.
Well, one observation I had, and I'd like your thoughts on this too, Dahlia. The Israelis claimed that they declared their bombing spree against the Gazans in self-defense, that people from Gaza were lobbing rockets into Israel, and they had to do this to protect themselves. That excuse was quickly exposed as a politician's lie. Did you have those kinds of discussions with the group there? Dahlia, what do you know of that?
I think it was Helen, what you said earlier, that you just really don't know. Until you've been there, you really don't know what it's like. And I was in Gaza quite a while ago, 1998, over 10 years ago. And that was a very hopeful time. It was a time when people really thought that things were on the upswing, and so much so that Gazans were really preparing for the influx of tourism that they were certain to come, and they were building tourist hotels on the shore, hoping that people, you know, once the blockades were lifted and Israel would let people in, that they would be able to invite people from around the world to come and vacation on their shores, much like the Israeli settlers who had a gorgeous and enormous, beautiful settlement in Gaza at the time, were enjoying the shores right there. It was really unfortunate that it never came to pass that people were able to come in. But when you think about people not being able to come in, people also need to realize that people aren't able to come out. They're not able to come out to work. They're not able to come out to get medical care. They're not able to come out to get an education. They're not able to come out to get food. And likewise, that stuff doesn't come in. And it truly is the world's largest open-air prison. what was really interesting to me about the Code Pink analysis and why I was so excited that Code Pink was really pushing a particular analysis out there into the public is that this organization was really focused in part on something that a lot of people tend to forget, and that seemed to be, you know, they put out an analysis of women and children. And one of the things, and I'd love for Helen or Felice, either of you, to talk about this, one of the things that you said that was really thought-provoking was that, you know, this has the highest population growth in the world, or one of the highest population growths in the world, rate of population growth. And so what that means is that a lot of women, a significant percentage of women, are either pregnant, just having given birth, or are nursing. They, in addition to their young children, are unable to access medical care and put in extreme risk because of Israel's actions.
As most of you know, the excuse that Israel used to bomb and invade Gaza was that Hamas was lopping over missiles and that they had broken the truce. Israel never kept to the truce to begin with, because part of the truce was to open up the borders, and this was never done. The borders have been tightly shut since Hamas was elected. So right from the get-go, Israel breached the ceasefire. Second of all, the number of missiles that went over from Gaza went down from something like 100 a day to 3 a day. So there was a definite attempt to cut down the number of missiles. There were other groups besides Hamas that were shooting over the missiles, like Islamic Jihad, which they tried to control, but maybe they couldn't. So I just think it was an excuse. And most people think, even Israelis, think that it was an attempt by Kadima, the party right before the election that had been in power, to show that they were strong and to recapture their reputation that they had lost during the invasion of Lebanon, that this was purely done to win the election. And it had nothing to do with the missiles. Now, to get to the point about women and children, this is very important. Code Pink was given an invitation by the women's section of the United Nations. So those were the people who actually extended our invitation, and the UN, UNRWA, was our host in Gaza. And we brought material aid and also baskets for 1,000 women filled with different products that women would appreciate, and we presented it to 1,000 women on International Women's Day. But to understand what this siege means, we met with some psychiatrists who said children are exhibiting what's known as a caged rat syndrome. That is, they feel like they're in a cage, they can't get out, and they can't sleep. They have attention deficit disorder. They're afraid to leave their parents' side. They're peeing in bed. And when we met with the women, I noticed among some of the older women severe depression. I mean, just imagine being under bombardment, having to leave your house. These women told me they would get calls from the Israelis saying, tell us, you know, where Hamas is, and we won't bomb your house. I think what happened to women and children and the murdering of innocent civilians, specifically women and children, was huge, as was, by the way, the targeting of medical professionals. These are all crimes under U.S. law.
Really, in my mind, this was not a whole lot different than what Israel had already been doing up until this point. This was just an extreme escalation. This is not about responding to Palestinian actions. This is not about responding to whether one person or a group or an elected government or whomever provides some sort of resistance to an illegal and inhumane occupation. This is simply an opportunity that they took to decimate an already destroyed area and its people.
I think that there are a couple of things that really people ought to know. First of all, Israel began planning this invasion in June. So it's not unreasonable. I mean, you know, if they can say, well, we had to have contingency plans. But within a week of the signing of the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel, which also took place in June, the agreement, Israel violated it by assassinating a senior Hamas official in the West Bank. So they began with assassinations. And really, the response, the rockets that came in response to Israeli actions came after assassinations, arrests and kidnapping of Hamas members in the West Bank, assassinations of people in Gaza. But second issue is really, If you are in Gaza, you say to yourself, why does Israel care about this place? What's the big deal? I mean, it's small, right? It's only 140 square miles. It's next to Egypt. It's on the other side of it is essentially desert. What do they care? And I think that there are two things that people haven't thought much about. One is that Gaza is an example to the West Bank. Gaza is an example to the West Bank. The settlement, the stealing of the land, the stealing of the water is taking place in the West Bank. Gaza is a lesson to people in the West Bank that resistance will be met with utter destruction. And what we saw in Gaza was utter destruction. And the second thing, which I think very few people are aware of, is that in 1999, natural gas reserves were discovered in the coastal waters of Gaza. And the proven reserves, meaning where the wells have already been drilled and the amount of reserves have been identified, is there is $4 billion worth of proven reserves, is 1.4 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. Israel began negotiating in 1999 to get control of that natural gas, which clearly belongs to the Palestinians. The negotiations have gone back and forth. To give you an idea of what Israel is trying to negotiate, there, at one point there was an agreement that they would give the Palestinian Authority $2 billion worth of goods and services, not money, in exchange for control of the natural gas. But they have been determined to control it. One of the things we saw when we were in Gaza is that Israel has built two natural gas platforms, drilling platforms, in a place where there doesn't appear to be any natural gas, right off the city of Ashkelon, the city right north of Gaza. So most Gazans believe that Israel is now slant drilling in to take that natural gas, and that's a resource that they would very much like to have their hands on. So those are a couple of reasons why this, what would be otherwise, I have to say, an insignificant piece of property is being contested.
I also wanted to just mention the vindictiveness of the Israelis, yes, in doing this, in the attempt to wear down the Gazans' fighting spirit, to not allow pasta. I mean, even Hillary Clinton couldn't figure out why Israel was not allowing pasta, sugar, candy, jam, and other products. They have forbidden any building materials. And I agree with you that these attacks have been going on for a long time, but there was kind of a change. I mean, the whole infrastructure has been destroyed. 95% of the factories are closed down. Desalinization plants have been bombed. Children now have kidney disease because the Israelis have siphoned off the good water and bombed the salinization plants, and there's too much seawater and salt seeping into the wells. 16 university buildings have been razed. 27 hospitals have been damaged. This was really a targeted attempt to break down the complete infrastructure. 4,000 homes were destroyed, and so on and so forth. It was really just an attempt to level the whole country. And the most severe damage in terms of civilians was on the outskirts of the border regions, where tanks came in and just leveled communities. We visited a community of 400 tents because people's houses were just totally destroyed and many people were killed. We talked to a man whose two daughters had been killed because of a tank running over his house, and the third daughter was now in Belgium getting medical care but would not return to normal. We met with Dr. Abu Laish, who happened to be on the phone talking to an Israeli news program when missiles hit his house and killed three of his daughters and a niece. He was a doctor in Israel. He worked for a hospital in an Israeli settlement right outside of Gaza. There was just wanton killing of civilians and destruction of the infrastructure.
It's important to note that every single day we were in Gaza, there was either bombing or shelling. So this is not over. And I checked with a member of our delegation who had stayed to do some filming. And as of last week, when he emailed me back, he was still in Gaza. He said, bombing and shelling has continued every day. Yeah. So either tunnels are being bombed, the fishermen are being shelled. Fishermen used to be limited to 6 miles. Then the Israeli Navy told them they could only go out 2 miles. Now they can only go out 150 yards. can't make much of a living as a fisherman at 150 yards, and even some of them are being shelled. In addition, Israel declared a no man's land of a kilometer and a half on the eastern border of Gaza. That's where all the agricultural land is. While we were there, farmers were being shot at and sniped if they tried to cultivate their land. And when you think about an area that's, 140 square miles, a kilometer and a half on the border is about 10% of the entire territory, which has now been declared a no man's land, the most fertile area. So the attacks are continuing every day. There have been a couple of what I have to describe as random bombings of the Jabalia refugee camp where people were killed. This is within the last week. Think of the Bronx. That's kind of about how densely populated Jabalia is. So you drop a bomb there, you're going to be killing people. But the very saddest thing we saw, in my opinion, was talking to the people in the tents. I mean, you can say, well, in any natural disaster, there are people in tents. There were people after Katrina in tents and trailers. But these people are staying in their tents because there is no cement, there's no glass, there's no reconstruction material, there's no heavy equipment being allowed in. So they're not going anywhere. This is a generation of people. There's 1.5 million people in Gaza. Two-thirds of them were in tents in 1948. They are refugees. So they're basically have gone from whatever their parents and grandparents had managed to salvage from being refugees from Israel to being back to 1948, which I think has to be crushing psychologically to people.
We're speaking with Helen Schiff and Felice Gelman, who have just returned from Gaza as part of the Code Pink delegation. Some 70 people went on that delegation. We've got Dalia Hashad from Washington, D.C. Dalia, you had a question?
We're seeing a decline in Gaza in terms of the standard of living. That's not just over the past year, but that's been happening for a while. And that's why I call this an escalation. All of the methods that we saw Israel use were vastly escalated, right, but none of them are new. And we saw, indeed, that in 2006, for example, you had over 60% of the population living in absolute poverty. And then we saw in 2008, the UN says that number rose to 80%. Do you have any idea what that number's at now?
I don't think they've know that yet.
When Israel withdrew its armed forces, its land forces from Gaza, it did so after negotiating an agreement with the United States and Egypt. The agreement was that, yes, we will withdraw if the U.S., Egypt, and the European Union all work together to reduce the flow of weapons into Gaza. Now, this is really akin to George Bush's weapons of mass destruction. I want you to understand that Israel claims that the Hamas is arming itself through tunnels which go under the border into Egypt, from Gaza to Egypt. Now, these tunnels have a diameter of about 4 feet. I'm unaware of any tanks, armored personnel carriers, even large missiles which can enter through a tunnel with 4-foot diameter. Are there some weapons coming in? I'm sure there are. There are guns. You know, they're assault rifles. The assault rifles were not very effective against the F-16s that bombed Gaza, and I don't think they represent a serious threat to Israel. But why did they make this such a big deal about closing the tunnels? Because the tunnels are the only way that people in Gaza have survived. And now the U.S. and Egypt have committed themselves basically to helping Israel tighten the siege against Gaza. And that was the price that Israel extracted for withdrawing its troops. It's really important for people to understand that when the U.S. says, well, we've had a great victory, we got the Israelis to declare a unilateral ceasefire and withdraw from Gaza, this was not a victory. The U.S. gave Israel the right to demand that the siege be tightened.
You know, we've been talking a lot about Israel, and I just want to say, people in Gaza know, and we should know, that Israel could not be doing this, yes, if it wasn't for the aid they're getting from the United States. 30% of all U.S. foreign aid goes to Israel. Obama has just pledged to continue the money that Bush gave to Israel, which comes out to $30 billion for the next decade. all the military aid that the U.S. gives to Gaza is against U.S. law because you're not supposed to be aiding a country, giving military aid to a country that it's using it to break human rights, to murder civilians. The white phosphorus that the U.S. has sent is supposed to be used only as a smokescreen, but was dropped onto school children in a UN school. And when we were there, we were told to be very careful not to walk through ruins because that phosphorus is still there. And any time it touches a human skin, it starts to burn. You know, and what people continually pointed out is that the U.S. bears responsibility and they can stop it if they want to by just not providing aid to Israel. So this is really our problem.
Let's talk about what we can do about it. I know the Code Pink is planning an action in May. Tell us about that, and then we'll put up links on our website at Law and Disorder.
That's great. Thanks. I think that Code Pink still thinks that the biggest issue is the siege and opening the borders. And so the plan is to bring more delegations to Gaza on May 22nd through June 14th, so to have a convergence of people all over the world, really, on Gaza to come through Egypt to the Rafah checkpoint, to go through Israel to the Eretz checkpoint, and to work with the Free Gaza movement, which has brought boats to try to break the naval blockade. So all of those forces are aiming to converge on Gaza in that May 22nd to June 14th time period. We need people who want to go on the delegations. We need to raise money to help make this a reality.
I want to ask you briefly about accountability. The Haaretz started publishing some earlier this month or last month, publishing accounts from Israeli soldiers about what happened there that was clearly indicative of clear war crimes. And then just recently, the UN initiated the Board of Inquiry into what happened in Gaza. What are hopes for actual accountability in this situation?
The Israeli army responded to those Haaretz articles by saying that they would initiate an investigation. And they were unbelievably efficient. I think that people really should be proud of them. They managed to investigate all of these allegations in, I think it was less than a week, and conclude that there was absolutely nothing to them. It was all rumors.
Hearsay, yes.
All rumors, and they were able to find no basis for it. I think that that's even better than they did with their investigation of the murder of Rachel Corrie in Gaza a number of years ago when she was run over by an Israeli army bulldozer.
Supplied by U.S. corporations.
Supplied by U.S. corporations, in which they found absolutely no culpability. But it took them a while to actually come to that conclusion, whereas they were able to investigate this whole problem in less than a week. The issue for culpability is obviously going to reside outside of Israel because Israel is not showing any interest in really trying to get to the bottom of what was going on. It's going to, I think, reside with international organizations. The Palestinian Committee for Human Rights has done a lot of work in themselves documenting what happened and also working with other organizations. And so I think it's going to reside with those organizations and with hopefully some of the braver countries who are prepared to take on international crimes against humanity like this. I mean, we saw that Spain has decided to investigate the culpability of American officials for torture. They've in the past looked at other issues of oppression. So we're hopeful. I mean, that's where we have a hope for some responsibility to occur.
But in light of the fact that so many crimes, human rights crimes, are committed daily by the State of Israel against the Palestinian people who they occupy, and there's almost no accountability for any of it, do you think that this is what's going to wake people up and make a shift, or are people going to forget about this?
I think the invasion of Gaza and the attacks on Gaza has represented a turning point. I feel that there's much more outrage around the world and in the United States. And I think our hope is to make Gaza and the West Bank an issue the way apartheid was in South Africa, the central issue that people around the world focus on and help to change.
Thank you so much for the work that you're doing and for getting out the message.
Thank you, Helen. Thank you, Felice, very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks a lot for having us.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
This year's Left Forum, which will be held in New York City at Pace University from April 17th to 19th, is going to be the biggest one ever, with over 200 panels of scholars and activists from across the country and around the world. We have with us in the studio today Professor, editor, and author Vivek Chibber, who's a board member of the Left Forum, to talk to us about the event. Vivek is a professor of sociology at NYU. He is the co-editor of the Socialist Register and is the author of Locked in Place, State Building and the Late Industrialization in India. Welcome, Vivek Chibber, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
I served with you on the board of the Left Forum. You're here to talk to us about it. The Left Forum is going on from April 17th to 19th this year. Turning Points is what it's called. I don't know if our listeners are aware, but the Left Forum is the largest annual conference of the United States and international leftists in North America, a tradition that goes back many, many years. This year it's going to be held at Pace University. I understand there are over 200 panels. There's an opening plenum and there's a closing plenum. You're going to be speaking at a panel on American barbarism. Tell us, before we talk about the panel, how'd you get involved in the Left Forum? Where are you coming from?
I have been in New York now for 10 years, and about 4 years ago, the board of the Left Forum got in touch with me and asked if I'd be interested in getting involved on the board. And I was more than happy to say yes, because while the Left Forum per se is a kind of a recent institution, this is what used to be known as the Socialist Scholars Conference, and for anybody on the left in the United States who's coming out of the kind of intellectual or academic scene, this was really something of a fixture. It was an annual event where, as you say, everybody who was in or around the left made it a point to come. So it was kind of an honor for me to be asked to join, and it was almost impossible to say no. So over the last 3 years now, I think it's been 3 years, I've been involved in helping set it up, and it's been an honor, and it's been tremendous fun for me.
And this year, you're on a panel having to do with barbarism in the United States. Tell me a little bit about what you're going to be talking about.
Well, the panel is really, it's a panel organized by the Socialist Register. And it deals with the theme of this year's Register. The Register is an annual publication, so it comes out once a year. And each year, it has a thematic, some kind of thematic unity. This year's volume is around the issue of violence, the various forms that violence takes under capitalism, but especially under the neoliberal capitalism that we've seen over the past generation. So a panel is going to specifically bring up three of the people who contributed to this volume, myself, Ruthie Gilmore, and Phil Green. And what it's going to then highlight is the ways in which the various dimensions of violence within capitalism, recent capitalism, and my paper, my presentation specifically, is going to deal with the violence of American foreign policy. And there, I think what I'll be focusing on is the Middle East in specifically, Iraq in particular, but also extending further east to Afghanistan. And what we'll talk about is the elements of continuity. First of all, what were the motives and the interests behind Bush's invasion of Iraq? What role did the Democratic Party play in facilitating and abetting that invasion? And what elements of continuity can we observe so far, and what elements can we expect from now onto the twilight years of the Obama presidency?
Yeah, that's a really insightful, important panel to have, Vivek. The conference altogether is being held under the theme of turning points. Why did you choose turning points as the conference theme?
Well, it's interesting. Last year's theme was cracks in the edifice, where the economic crisis was starting to hit last year, and the debacle in Iraq for American power and American foreign policy also was generating a series of setbacks for Bush's agenda on a world scale. So last year we sort of thought, you know, it's interesting that you are beginning to see some real tremors in American power, both domestically in its economy and also outside in its foreign ventures. So, of course, between last year and this year, it turned out that cracks in the edifice really turn into complete collapse. Whenever a ruling order collapses, you find yourself and you find the population finds itself at a turning point. Because as Rosa Luxemburg said a very, very long time ago, when the ruling order is collapsing and there's no immediate progressive replacement that we see, you find yourself, people find themselves at a turning point where you could seize the opening, progressive forces could seize the opening and push for a more progressive and a more egalitarian and a more just social agenda. But there's also the other side. And a crisis is always an opportunity not for just the forces of progress, but also the forces of reaction. So for those of us who consider ourselves on the left, it's a turning point potentially in a good way. We could seize this crisis as a way of putting forward demands for a revival of some kind of social welfare, some kind of pro-labor policies, policies in favor of women, which recognize the plight of minorities. On the other hand, this could also be a time when the right seizes it to further demonize the poor, to further demonize minorities, to clamp down on our civil liberties. So that's why we thought this would be an important theme for a conference such as this, because we do feel that we're at an absolutely critical juncture right now in the evolution of the American political economy.
Vivek Chibber, you're a professor at NYU. You are now one of the co-editors of the Socialist Register. You're going to be giving one of the important panels at the Left Forum this year. But talk to me about some of the other panels that come under that overall theme of turning points.
For the way the Left Forum is organized, it's kind of this a gigantic smorgasbord of everybody on the left. So year to year, we have an enormous variety of panels, and it probably would be a little bit difficult to give you a flavor of everything that's out there. The best way to give you some sense is to talk about the way in which the board has tried to bring some kind of thematic unity to and put a kind of a spine that runs through the conference, whatever the other varieties of panels might be. The highlight for us in that regard is, of course, our two plenaries, which we organized, the opening plenary and the closing.
Talk to me about some of the panels that you think are really important and kind of the highlights of the conference. Yeah.
Well, two that I really hope everyone comes to are the opening and closing plenaries, both one of which will, the opening plenary will deal with all the different dimensions of the crisis right now, the economic crisis, and one of our board members, Rick Wolf, will be one of the speakers on that, but also the political and the foreign policy dimensions to this.
That's on April 17th, the opening plenum at Pace University, and then the Left Forum closing plenum is on April 19th.
Yeah, and the closing plenum will deal really with the issue of where do we go from here? What can we do?
And you can get the personnel for the opening and closing plenums, and the 200 panels in between, if you go to www.leftforum.org. That's leftforum.org. But talk to me more about the economic panels, the panels on the Democratic Party and Obama. Why do you think those are important?
Well, we're going to have several panels on the crisis, and there are going to be at least one or two on each day, some of which are organized by the board. But, of course, because of the depth of this crisis, we got a lot of applications from people who wanted to organize their own.
I never saw anything like it. It's huge. It's the largest conference ever. And I've been going to these things since 1967.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody realizes that this is a time when we've got to try to get some sense, some analysis of what's going on. Because one thing is clear is that what was coming out of the mainstream media, the mainstream economics profession, the business press for the past 20 to 25 years was basically hallucinations. This kind of absolutely shameful justification for policies, for measures that were economically disastrous and socially absolutely devastating for communities. So now the problem is that the business press that was for decades singing the praises of this economic model that was based on nothing now is the only source that people have for information as to what to do. And there's been a complete loss of legitimacy. Not only is there a loss of legitimacy for the economic model of neoliberalism, but there's a corresponding loss of legitimacy for all the intellectuals, the journalists, and all the media gurus who were promoting it all this time. So where do you go? Where do you go for some kind of analysis as to what actually was going on the last 20 years and what the real nature of the crisis is? This is a gigantic opening for the left of the kind that we haven't seen in a generation. So I think that's what explains why people are flocking to something like the forum now. And our duty has been to try to organize as many of these panels as we can. And there are going to be a lot of them.
It seems to me that the Obama honeymoon is coming up short, that the bloom is falling off the rose rather quick, and that although people were certainly and understandably and justifiably elated that the racism was suppressed enough in this country that a black man could get elected president, the whole issue of class was kind of overlooked. And it seems to me that that is coming to the fore now with, for example, the bankers calling the shots on the economic recovery. Talk to me about the kind of panels that are going to address that question, not just on economics, but panels on the Democratic Party and what the Democratic Party really is.
One of our major panels will be, I think it's going to be on Saturday evening. And that's going to be a panel in which one of our board members, Bill Fletcher, is going to put on his Phil Donahue hat. And he's going to have people on who he will then quiz, as it were, and get their opinions upon where the Obama presidency could be going now and what kind of sense to make of it. And there are going to be several more over the course of the weekend, which is explicitly dealing with the phenomenon of the Obama presidency. Because as you say, on the one hand, it's deeply significant and a tremendous step forward in this country for an African-American to be elected president. I mean, it's going to just create such an incredible cultural shift for all these young children, African-American children who are growing up, to be able to see a black man as their president. It has also, for the first time, forced the issue of race onto the public agenda in the last 10 or 12 years, in an era in which the Republican Party and the right had basically just refused to even acknowledge the problems of racism in this country. However, as you're saying, at the same time, Obama, who came to power on these pledges of deep and massive social change and radical change, has pretty much been business as usual. And if you look carefully at what he's doing, I think what's obvious is that his primary worry has been not to take advantage of the opportunity that he's been given by this crisis to try to enact some kind of progressive, just any kind of progressive social agenda. His main worry has been to contain the pressures to do that, not to take advantage of them. And I think for the left, the realization has to be that he has to be pushed a little bit because he surrounded himself with Clintonite Democrats who come out of the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Caucus, which is, it's politely called a centrist organization, but it's a corporate right-wing organization within the Democratic Party. And unless Obama is pressured from below, from the streets, then the suits and the suites are going to call the shots.
Obama himself acknowledged that when he was in the primary race in Iowa. He and Hillary were standing there, and a reporter asked him on Martin Luther King Day who he thinks Martin Luther King would have voted for. And Obama thought for a second and said, you know, I don't think he would have voted for either one of us. He would have been out on the streets making us do something.
Yeah.
As kind of an invitation to do it. But, you know.
Well, not really. If you look at what happened afterwards. I mean, just look at what he's done with health care. Let's say that Obama really, he recognizes that you need public pressure. And he recognizes that there isn't enough pressure. And he needs that as leverage to try to pass his reforms, right? All right, well, the rational thing to do for him would have been on healthcare to say, I don't know if we can do this, but I want to put single-payer healthcare on the table. This is what Canada has. Some kind of national insurance is everywhere in Europe. And the single-payer option is the one most Americans prefer. The polls have been showing it for over 20 years now. And it's one that's the easiest to implement. So at the very least, I want to put it on the table. Now, that would have created an opening for all these social groups, all the lobbying groups, all the citizens' organizations, the labor unions that are pushing for single payer. It would have been a signal to them that, hey, if you can get your act together, if you can mobilize, if you can create pressure, I might be able to really do something with this. Well, what does he do? The first day when he organizes his summit on healthcare, he says everything is on the table except one thing, and that's single payer. He said that is off the table. Right? So he may give lip service to this notion that politics is about mobilizing and that people, ordinary citizens, have to mobilize and give you the impression that he will be the ear, the open mind that gives a voice to all these popular pressures. But there hasn't been much indication so far, and I think he's going to have to be pushed a lot harder than we expected.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that the problem, as the Democrats see it, is that if they give a little encouragement to people out on the street to mobilize, how do they stop it?
Exactly.
They will have created for them a monster.
Exactly.
And so although some of them will give lip service to the idea of pressuring us from below, like Obama did in Iowa, to actually do it is really riding the back of the tiger, and they could end up inside.
Yeah, consider the last 20, 25 years, the party has been trying to shed what it sees as a liability for itself, which is being handy, which is being burdened. Narrow interests like working people, like the poor, like women's organizations. It's been trying to demobilize them.
Professor Vivek Shibber, one of the members of the board of directors of the Left Forum. It's going to be going on here in New York City, April 17th through 19th. There's some 200 panels. You got a little flavor of what it's going to be like just from the discussion that Vivek has been conducting here in the studio. Invite you to please come to it. Check out the panels and the opening and closing plenary on leftforum.org. That's leftforum.org. There's some 200 panels. To give you just an idea of some of the speakers, call out the names of some of the people that are going to be presenting at the Left Forum under the rubric of Turning Points.
Well, you can expect to see Walden Bellow, Adolph Reed, our own Francis Fox Piven, David Harvey, Bill Fletcher, Joel Covell, Hugo Blanco, Barbara Epstein, and many, many others.
Just a wonderful collection of left-wing intellectuals and activists. I think that if we're going to arm ourselves intellectually for the next period and do what has to be done, which isn't hanging around and voting every 2 or 4 years in the Democratic Party, this is a place to start. Turning Points, the Left Forum, 2009, the biggest and best left forum ever at Pace University in New York City, April 17th and 19th. Vivek Shibber, thank you very much for coming on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael. It was a pleasure.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.